by chance we're crossing the same roads all at one time. Even if you say it coming, no time to pay out gracefully. One thing I know for sure, there'll be no doubt when you see you are. Rest may have in the middle of it. Rest may have in the middle. We are rest may have.
Secret truth. Through forgiveness we awaken, transforming information and knowledge into wisdom. And now our co-hosts, Charlotte Littlefield and George Butler.
Welcome to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler. Coming up next is, Frank Gregory Ford. And he has a tremendous story to tell. I first interviewed him on his story back about, about 4 or 5 years ago. And, we published it at the time and it went up on the site, but not much was paid attention until this recent al-Baghdadi, event that occurred over in Syria, and President Trump sent those people out there, the special forces, rangers and special forces and so forth, and they took him down, And this particular person came into my knowledge through different people that I'd been investigating a series of different things about ISIS and so forth. And then I was trying to find out, well, who was behind ISIS and so forth. And then I stumbled on to Gregory Ford, and then his story is revealed quite a bit about it. But also, Aubie Grob came in to play, too, into his story. And his story, as you'll hear it unfold here in a few minutes, he actually was a whistleblower on weapons of mass destruction, VX gas, but he also blew the whistle on Aubie Grob, the prison, where there were all kinds of different violations against the prisoners. And so when Gregory Ford blew the whistle on that, then he became, you could say, an enemy of the army, of the military, because they were trying to keep all of this under wraps and secret and away from the press. Well, the press got hold of this story, you could say, on the violations there at the prison, and just blew it up, and there were real problems there. But he goes back, and I said this the first hour, that Copper Green was a project underway where they were devising certain intimidative ways to break Iraqi prisoners, Arab prisoners. And what they did, they came up with, Seymour Hersh has an article. You can find it by going to Wikipedia and then going into Copper Green, and up will pop that article. But anyway, Seymour Hersh wrote an article about this. And what it was a means by which to go in and to break down these prisoners, these Arab prisoners, but to intimidate them and to demoralize them through forcing them to do sexual acts to one another that they normally would not do, because it was way outside of Islam, way outside of their teachings and so forth. In Islam, homosexuality is prohibited and banned, and it's absolute banned within Islam circles. And so by forcing these prisoners to do these kinds of homosexual types of acts, forcing them to under force and, intimidation and so forth, it broke them down to where it broke their morale and so forth. And so that's what the army was doing at that prison. And then along comes Frank Gregory Ford doing counterintelligence work, and stumbles on to Aubie Grob. First he had under interrogation al-Baghdadi in 2003. And so then from that, he learned more about later, Abu Ghraib, because that's where they transferred. They transferred al-Baghdadi over to Abu Ghraib prison. And as a result, then, you know what I mean, he was there and evidently witnessed some of these violations, you know, against the prisoners. I mean, it was like, you know, international law is what they were violating in every way that they could. The jail keepers there. And it became just a big scandal, you know, in the army. But they evidently, it was successful in breaking those prisoners to get intelligence from them. I think that there were probably better ways to get information, than that. But at the time, they didn't think it was SOs, but they went ahead and did these kinds of, intimidative, you know, techniques against the prisoners. Well, anyway, that will be coming up. On our first hour, I got into the POW question, and that's always been stuck in my craw for years, and it just wasn't right what went on. And as a result, it wasn't what we should have been doing. You know what I mean? We should have been protecting our prisoners and our POWs especially, and bringing them back from harsh incarceration in North Vietnam. God bless people like Captain Eugene Red McDaniel that tried, and all these other people. Bill Hinden wrote a book, An Enormous Crime, and he tried to bring out the fact about what was going on over there, and he was not successful. But he worked along with Captain Eugene Red McDaniel, and he founded a foundation to try to, and worked with all the family members of the POWs and so forth. And he wasn't able to overcome the stone wall that Congress, politicians, and all the lobbyists, I mean, all these different, you could say, the deep state put up in their way. Because they did not want it known to the public that they had abandoned these POWs over there. And I think it was for trade relationships is why they wrote them off. So there were very courageous men, very brave and courageous men that died over there at the hands of the Vietnamese jail keepers, prison keepers, jailers, you could say, under very harsh conditions. And today, I think most of those people are probably passed away. And I think that's what this deep state counted on. So that really, in the essence, is what President Trump is up against. He's up against these kinds of people, okay, that don't give a damn, okay, about what's going on in this world. And they don't give a damn about the American citizens, much less these foreign people, countries. They just want to maintain their absolute control, and money, it's money based and it's money. But at the very top, you've got a psychopathic character types. Those psychopathic characters are running the things at the top, but they're mixing in the secret societies and the mystery school and all of this other occult stuff is mixed into their management of this very harsh regime. And they're doing it on a sophisticated basis using the media. The media is in there with them to continue to this dominance and of the American public at large. And so the American public at large is just looking around trying to find answers to what's going on, but they can't really find the answers because it's hidden. See, they've been propagandized too much. The average American citizen out here trying to work, take care of their children, their family, their wives and husbands and so forth, whatever. And they're just trying to make a living and trying to get ahead of the game, you could say. And as a result, it's not very encouraging what's been going on. But anyway, coming up next, right in a moment, will be this interview with Frank Gregory Ford. So thank you very much. Here we go right now. I've got one of the finest guests on the line with me this evening, Frank Gregory Ford. Welcome to our program.
Thank you, George. It's always good to be on your program. It's been a while, but yeah, I'm glad to be here.
And one thing about Frank is, my gosh, he's got insights unlike any guest that we've ever had over the 13 years that Charlotte Littlefield and I have been broadcasting. And he has a book out. It's just been published recently. I think October the 8th, this year, 2019, was the publishing date. The title, what's that?
2 weeks ago.
Yeah, 2 weeks ago.
2 weeks ago, George.
Right, so it's right out, right off the press, and boy, it's a gangbuster too. The title is Midnight in Samara, and where is Samara? Frank Gregory Ford, where is this? What is this about,
okay,
man? Tell us about it.
Okay, well, Samara, okay, is the S, that, by the way, that's spelled S-A-M-A-R-R-A. Okay, now, that's in Iraq, the old ancient capital of Mesopotamia. All right. And, now there's a Samara, Russia, which is almost dead center in Russia. It's right on the Volga River, but this is Samara, which is the old, capital, the old capital of Mesopotamia. And it is known in the Bible as the city of gold. Okay. And that's where the old ancient, gold brokerage, of the Middle East took place, was in Samara, Iraq, or Samara, Mesopotamia. And so the reason why I ended up there was something like this, is I had been sent, of course, to Iraq as in a counter, what's called a counterintelligence mode, force protection, trying to figure out how endangered our people were going to be there by all the plots and subplots and intrigues that were going on in the Middle East. And so I was there, and my first city that I was at was a place called Balad, B-A-L-A-D, okay, Balad. And of course, if we watch the press, it is now known as, actually everybody in the U.S. knows it as Mortarville, okay, because of all the attacks that happened there. But I happened to be there, and I was there 2 days. You know, I was in Balad 2 days, and I had walked over to the Tigris River. You know, there's two rivers in Iraq, big rivers, the Euphrates and the Tigris. And I'd walked over to the Tigris, and with a security team of agents, intelligence agents, and we walked over to, and we decided that we were going to speak to the water plant manager, okay, because this was a big Air Force base, so they had to draw their water from the Tigris, and they had to treat it before they could use it. And so we thought, oh, hey, what better way to get a little intelligence work, you know, than just walk over and talk to their plant manager. So we did, and I'm rushing through this, and I'm sure there's plenty of questions that everybody would ask. But the thing was, is as we walked over there, I was providing security for my team who was talking to the manager on the river. And this is on the Tigris River. And, you know, it was almost like a book, almost like a story. I looked up on top of a small hill, and where there was some, you know, housing, officer housing, right along the river, and a fellow came walking down, saw me, came walking down, and he was wearing black dish dash, and he had a little girl with him. He turned out to be his daughter. And so they walked down, he introduced himself to me, I introduced myself to him, and to make a long story short, it turned out this was the commander of the fighter bomber wing that had dropped weapons of mass destruction on the Kurds, okay, yes, those Kurds that were busy betraying and selling out right now, okay, those Kurds, and also the Iranians or the Persians, given the fact that the Iraqis and the Iranians had just finished up a 12-year war, maybe a 15-year war, okay, so And so these weapons of mass destruction have been dropped on the Iranians too. Okay. So much for worrying about the Iranians have weapons of mass destruction when we should be the ones that are watched very closely, because we actually, it turns out, produced and sold the weapons of mass destruction to Saddam Hussein, who was working for us in he had been working for us since 1958. And, he was our agent. Yes, Saddam Hussein was our CIA-controlled agent. Okay, I'm sure it's got everybody's imagination really working overtime. But anyway, this fellow came walking up to me and introduced himself. And yes, he was a commander. And he said, when the first things he said was out of his mouth was, "Well, I suppose you being a an American and all." Want to know where our weapons of mass destruction are. And I said, "Oh, well, of course I do. Hey, what better way could we, you know, get out of Iraq? You know, it was 130 degrees on that day." I said, of course, I took him up on his offer. And the next day he came over to where I was there at Balad on the Air Force base. And we walked over about 100 yards, less than 100 yards from where we were at that point, where my command had set up shop. And, we actually went down, you know, down into a bunker, an old bunker in Iraq on Balad. And we ended up finding, and this is, by the way, this is in the book, George. Okay. For your listeners.
Okay.
You read this in the book, Midnight and Samara. Okay. This is all in detail. All right. So we went over and went down in the bunker. And of course, I figured I'd done some really stupid things in my life, but this had to have been one of the stupidest, as going with a foreign, enemy officer, you know, into an underground bunker looking for something that they weren't supposed to have. All right. So I just figured I was probably, maybe the people on your show were going to end up seeing me get my head cut off on the internet or something like that, you know. But as it turns out, I kept my gun on him the whole time when we were walking in this bunker, and got down and we found we opened the door, and I let him go first in case the place was booby trapped, and we ended up finding, you know, row after row, stack after stack, you know, weapons of mass destruction like you've never seen before, George. You can't imagine what was in there. But there was virtually enough to probably kill the entire United States. If dropped properly, these VX canisters, VX/CF canisters, could have probably killed most of the people in the United States. Okay, that's what type of WMD they were, weapons of mass destruction. So anyway, I reported those, and the strangest, this is when things started to act like I was falling down a rabbit hole, George.
Okay.
Okay. Now it really felt like that. I came back. I took a part of one of these canisters, these 1,000 pound bomb canisters. I took it off the dispersal door, took it back, and also I took the bills of lading. Okay. And the bills of lading had said, I guess this relates to anybody in Texas, okay, is that these bills of lading meant that these weapons had been developed in Fort Rucker, Alabama, and they had been stored in a place called Pine Bluffs, Arkansas, chemical warfare, you know, storage area. And when Saddam Hussein purchased these weapons were loaded up on a train and a freight train and shipped to the Houston Waterway, okay, as in Houston, Texas.
Okay, Houston Ship Channel is what we call that. Yeah.
Oh, okay, the Ship Channel, okay. Yeah, well, hey, I'm a Californian.
Right,
okay.
We call that the Houston Ship Channel. Yeah, okay.
The Ship Channel, okay, right. I'll go for that.
Okay.
Okay, because there I was in a bunker trying to figure all this out.
Sure.
Okay,
sure.
A bunker that was about 140 degrees. Okay, so, and I was reading all this under a red light. I turned on a red light to prevent the detonation of any kind of booby trap in the bunker. So I was reading under a red light and said that these WMD were loaded up on a ship, a material transport ship called the USS Wabash, and they were shipped to Spain, from Spain airlifted into Iraq. So yes, we had WMD. I don't care what George W. Bush says or any of those other phony balonies from the Bush family. And yes, we had plenty of WMD there, and that's where it came from. And by the way, the company that had produced these weapons of mass destruction was called Carlyle. I think there's some sort of connection there, if I remember correctly. But anyway, so I took the dispersal door, returned it, and it had the strangest damn thing. It had the GSN number. What does that stand for, George? General Supply Number?
Yeah,
since
okay.
You were in the military, and okay, the GSN number, and I took it back. I dropped it on my commander's desk, and I said, okay, here they are. And he took one look. He said, oh, my God. And he went out, and he jumped in his Humvee, drove the 100 yards over to the bunker, and came back about half hour later and said, oh, my God, I've discovered the mother load of weapons of mass destruction. And I said, okay, right. Well, I'll let you, Commander, I'll let you talk to the CNN folks. And at that point, he said, CNN? I said, yeah, right. They set up transportation not very far from here, about 100 yards, okay, 100 meters. And he said, well, I'm going to call the Pentagon first and see what they say. And he did. And he gave him the number, and also he gave him a copy of the bills of lading. Okay. And almost immediately the response back was, put a clamp on that bunker. Don't let anybody in that bunker. We are sending the British chemical weapons team over to destroy those weapons, because the Americans didn't have a self-destruction weapon, or excuse me, a destroying unit that could handle the destruction of those weapons. And they said, under no circumstances are you to tell CNN or any other news agency about these weapons, under a pain of death, basically. So then, okay, and then I thought it was rather strange, because like within 45 minutes after I discovered those weapons of mass destruction, I was given a set of orders to go to the ancient city of Samarra. Okay. It's like they couldn't get me out of Dodge fast enough. All right. At least I talked to somebody.
Right.
So anyway, okay. So now we're coming up on what relates to what's going on today, this morning, as of last night. Okay. So, And by the way, how am I coming across, George?
Well, you're coming across great, and this is working out really good. You've got a good chronological order going too, Frank. It's sounding good.
Okay. The reason I'm asking you is right now in California, we have a storm, a windstorm that's probably about 80 to 100 miles an hour blowing. Okay.
Oh my gosh.
So we have a roaring fire. Okay, forest fire. That has caused the evacuation of 200,000 people on the coast right now, as I'm saying this.
Okay.
So let me know if I need to change any of this story
just keep going. Keep rolling. We'll take as long
good.
As you need. You have plenty
okay,
of time
so,
on here. Okay.
Okay, good. So at this point, I was told, load up my Humvee and drive up to the city of Samarra. Okay. And if you go look in the Bible, yes, there's a pretty wonderful passage concerning the city of Samarra, the golden city of Samarra. And what it is, if you read the Bible, you can pull it out and look at it. And it's called, the passage is called Appointment in Samarra. Okay. And what that is a gold merchant, is in Baghdad, And he looks up one day, he's in the marketplace, he sees the specter of death looking at him. And so he decides to go to the city of Samara, where I went, and on the road, which I took, to the city of Golden City of Samara, he's there, he arrives after a panicky flight, you know, to get up there, a panicky drive. He gets there, he walks into the gold marketplace in Samara, and who does he see looking at him? He sees death, okay?
Oh, my God.
So, yes, so needless to say, I had this story in the back of my mind, okay? So as I'm headed up to Samara. So anyway, I get up to Samara, and the first evening I was there, let's see, how did it go? Okay. I had just turned in. It had been a long day. We took up residence in a police station, the old Saddam Hussein's police station, which had all the chains and torture chains and cells and meat hooks hanging from the ceiling. You know, typical Saddam Hussein hotel. Okay.
Right.
So I took up residence in there, just a moment. Hey, kids. Hey. Okay. Sorry, I had to talk to my grandkids.
No, that's okay.
So anyway, okay. So, there I was at about, maybe 12 o'clock at night. I decided to lay down, get some sleep. And about 15 minutes later, 20 minutes later, in walks two Shia policemen. Okay, there's two types of Muslims in this area of Iraq. Those are the Sunnis and the Shia. Okay, and the Shia policemen walk in. They said, "Well, hey look, we have somebody in our custody, and we think you need to go talk to this guy." Okay, and I said, "Well, why is that?" And they said, "Well, he's a lieutenant colonel in the Mukhabarat." Okay, I want to make sure everybody understands what these are. Lieutenant colonel in the Mukhabarat. Okay, the Mukhabarat is the secret intelligence service, very feared in Iraq. Okay, in all of Iraq, and it was in the organization was built by our former CIA. And for Saddam Hussein, it was designed, the whole organization was designed to keep him in power. Okay. Make sure that he wasn't threatened, along with the SAVAK, the intelligence group of Iran, and also the other intelligence group, that was supporting, Colonel Gaddafi. Okay. The other Colonel Gaddafi. And also, I'll just give this free to your listeners.
Okay.
Because they're listening on Sunday. There's also the other facility in Syria. Okay. The intelligence group in Syria, which is also called the Mukhabarat. Okay. In Syria.
Okay.
All right.
Okay.
Okay. So there I was. Okay. And I said, okay. All right. I've got to get up, you know, after a long, thoroughly long day, went in, talked to this guy. And the first, you know, and of course I had the two Shia policemen that were accompanying me, and they walked into the room, and they, before we walked in, they said, look, this guy's name is Al-Ghazi al-Baghdadi. Okay. Al-Ghazi al-Baghdadi. Okay. And I said, well, okay. All right. You know, to me, he was just another Iraqi. And they said, no, he works for the Mukhabarat. He's extremely dangerous. Okay. And, I said, okay, great. All right. So is there something special about him that I should know? And they said, he knows where your female soldier is. Okay. And I said, he knows where our female soldier that was missing. And they said, yes, he has her did have her in his custody. And that was Jessica Lynch, the name Jessica Lynch, who was the soldier that had been taken prisoner, inadvertently. So, when we invaded Iraq. And so they were taken prisoner. She was taken prisoner. And this fellow that I was looking at, okay, I'm almost 6 feet tall. And this fellow was about 5 foot five. But he had a real definite mean look about him. Okay. And he looked at me, and the first thing he said was, he kind of laughed. He said, "By the way, I know where your female soldier is, and we're showing your female soldier a really good time." And I should have known better. I let him get the better of me at that point. I just met him, but he got the better of me because I realized what he was talking about. Okay. How they were treating this female soldier. Okay. And I think everybody knows who Jessica Lynch is now. They should. But, anyway, I said, I have to admit, like I say, I snapped and I said, I told the, two Shia policemen, I said, "Look, okay, this little bastard, okay, he's telling me that he knows where she is and he has her and they're hurting her. They're torturing her. So I said, okay, here's what you can tell him. You can translate for me is that I'm going to find out what anything, whatever was done to her, Jessica Lynch, I'm going to make sure that you two policemen are going to do to him. So as he translated, I actually felt a real sense of, what's the word, satisfaction, because as I was watching him, he's a rather dark Middle East, Mesopotamian, and I could see actually he lost all the color drained out of his face when they translated what they were going to do to him if she had been hurt in any way. So, and I know I'm making this go by quickly, George, but I'm trying, cause it's a fairly long story, but I want to make sure that everybody gets this whole story, especially now on the day that Al-Ghazi al-Baghdadi, or AKA Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi has died. Okay. As of today, right. I want to make sure everybody understands that. So anyway, George, what happened then was, okay, I understood what was going to happen, and he could not actually, he started talking. And, you know, it's not like in the movies, you know, with intelligence agents, it's like, you know, where they tell them all kinds of intelligence agent, all kinds of secret stuff. Okay. Well, it's not like that in the movie, you know, not like that in real life. I was busy writing, and after a while, I couldn't write fast enough. So I told him, had to tell him, you know, shut up a couple of times. So I get caught up on my reports. And at that point, he said, "Well, look," he told the translators, "okay, here's where you can find your female soldier, Jessica Lynch." And of course I did. He told me, and I contacted my command and put what was called a flash warning, a double flash warning, and said, "Yes, we know where she is. She is at these coordinates, and pick her up. Go rescue her as soon as possible." Okay. And of course, you know, dealing with the military, you know, the military moves like with the speed of a lightning speed of a glacier. Okay. And so that's about how fast they were moving. But, eventually it took 2 to 3 days for them to locate and find her and rescue her. So anyway, I still had custody and control of Mr. al-Baghdadi. All right. So, I thought, okay, I got a response back saying, from my command saying, okay, all right, this guy probably thinks he's somebody special. So, the important thing is that if you do talk to him, try to get access to the Mukhabarat's, intelligence computers that they have. They have some of the largest, most extensive, massive, intelligence computers. They call them G2 computers. In the Middle East, okay, even bigger than Israel's, bigger than Egypt's, okay, any of those, okay, this guy has access and he probably has control. So I decided at that point, there in Samara, okay, to go ahead and try and recruit this fellow, okay, Mr. Baghdadi. Okay, so I made the proposal, made the approach, and yes, yeah, he realized, although the whole time he was looking at me like he wanted to kill me, okay, particularly, but he realized he had no choice other than to get recruited. Otherwise, he would probably not survive the rest of the week, okay, with us there and the angry Shia that were willing to take this guy out and execute him. So he, needless to say, and this is a direct point, and I want everybody to listen very carefully, is that Mr. Baghdadi was recruited in Samara, okay, on such a date, okay, about that date. This is in, June, okay, June of 2003, okay. I don't know the exact date. I forget. But anyway, he was recruited. And by us, okay, on about the June 15th, by the way, by us, and he was working for the United States of America, okay, at that time, from that point on. So, and everybody's probably saying, okay, are you kidding? This guy, he started ISIS, all right, and he launched one of the most horrific terror campaigns known to mankind. Well, that's all true. Yes. And so what happened was, is he worked for us. I tried to get my hands on those computers. That was the most important thing, is that database that he had, you know, that had been built up for 35 years. Okay. Under Saddam Hussein. And a couple, after several other adventures happened, I wasn't able to speak with him on a regular basis. Let me see. One of the first adventures was locating Saddam Hussein's banker, who purchased all the weapons of mass destruction. Also, the Saddam Hussein's banker, whose daughter was the mistress of Saddam Hussein. That was Abu Sajer. He's known as Abu Sajer. His daughter was the mistress of Saddam Hussein, and there was several amounts of intrigue going on, which are all recorded in my book, Midnight in Samara. You can read the book about, find out what the millions of dollars that were discovered by me in Samara at Abu Sajer's home. Okay. He's been looking up under Ali Saad Hassan. That is his actual real name. But he goes by the name, or did go by the name, till the CIA beat him to death, okay, in CIA custody. But they beat him to death because he did know who purchased and who sold weapons of mass destruction to Saddam Hussein. Okay. To name a couple of people, Dick Cheney is one of the people, all right, and Donald Rumsfeld is one of the other people, okay. They were the ones who sold the weapons of mass destruction directly to Saddam Hussein on the behalf of the Carlyle Group, okay, the Carlyle Group that was the beginning, that was the organization that George H.W. Bush founded, okay, and their sole function was to sell weapons of mass destruction to despotic regimes, okay, that group, yes, that company, all right. So, and I'm sure there's probably some questions at this point now. Are there any questions, George?
Well, yeah, that you have? I have some questions. Now, you were on the ground there, and you were questioning al-Baghdadi and so forth. And did you ever get your hands on any of these records, or were they passed on to the ISIS? Is that what ISIS eventually acquired from the databases and so forth? How did that work?
Well, boy, you're a sharp guy, George. It must be that military intelligence you were working with. Okay. Actually, I did not get my hands on the mainframes. Okay. that al-Baghdadi was responsible for or had control of. Those were actually in another section of Sumara, okay? It was called the records section, but I did not get my hands on them, okay, for several reasons, okay? And at that point, there were several intrigues going on, okay? Several intrigues with the U.S. or our U.S. forces, given the fact that tremendous amounts of money were being flown in into the what's called the green zone, flown into the green zone, and being flown out. Okay, this is in the book, and being flown out to our, you know, we're talking billions of dollars were being flown in and flown out. Okay, it was kind of like a clearinghouse for our operational forces, allied forces, specifically the UK. Okay, as in Tony Blair, were receiving, you know, billions of dollars of U.S. money to actually cooperate and collude with the U.S. and George W. Bush. So yes, so that is in the book. That's recorded. And by the way, that's an explosive issue for your listeners to understand this. Yes, that was found. And Senator Henry Waxman, who did the investigation, actually realized that yes, that was all true, and the Cyprus Express is what it was officially called. Cyprus Express was discovered and recorded by a Brigadier General Janusz Karpinski. All right, and the reason why I know that is because Janusz Karpinski was my, you know, top level of boss that I had to answer to. So Janusz Karpinski has notified me that yes, the money that was found with Saddam Hussein's banker was actually taken and put on board the Cyprus Express and shipped to the Cyprus Express and put in into several bribery accounts. And I say bribery, I mean exactly that. Bribery accounts. Okay, that we had set up, our government had set up to pay for the cooperation of several of our allies, quote allies. So when it came right down to it, all right, the situation had disintegrated for me. It was deteriorating for me because of finding Saddam Hussein's banker, all right, in Samarra. And then I could actually tell as I explained in the book, I could tell that things were getting politically, you know, too dangerous. Okay. I had notified my command that there was a severe acute torture methods going on in Abu Ghraib prison. Okay. The prison of Abu Ghraib. Okay. And I realized that we were going to lose control of Iraq as it was at that time. Now, I think pretty much everybody, all your listeners, who I'm sure are very intelligent and well-informed, George, thanks to you, they understood what Abu Ghraib prison is and was at the time and the implications of it. Because when the information came out on 60 Minutes, the 60-minute documentary done on how Americans were torturing Iraqis in their own country, in their own prison, all right, that's when we definitely started losing control of Iraq, you know, and it started in Samarra, and then, of course, it continued all the way to Abu Ghraib. Well, at that point, by the way, the banker who we arrested, he was taken out of our custody and control by the CIA and taken to Abu Ghraib prison, where he was a 72-year-old man, but he was put in and actively tortured in Abu Ghraib prison. And I don't know, and you were asking about whether I know, whether Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi actually ever turned over any of the mainframe database, what are called G2 systems. I don't think so. Okay. I don't think so because it turns out, much to my chagrin and much to my embarrassment, it turns out that Mr. Al-Baghdadi was playing a three-way game. Okay. He was actually, unbeknownst to me, he was a active Mossad agent for Israel. Okay.
Okay.
Active agent for Mossad Israel. And he had been inserted into Iraq. Okay. And where he was actively working for the Mukhabarat. Okay. I know this is confusing, but he was working for the Mukhabarat when we came into town, and he washed up on my doorstep. Okay. With the information on the young lady, okay, Jessica Lynch,
okay,
the soldier, okay. So me, I was third man in line to recruit, to control this guy. And that's why I didn't know all of this. Okay. It's not like people in the espionage business go around advertising, you know, issues like this. But, anyway, at that point, I was, you know, basically, when I said, hey, you know, to my command, which by the way is a Supreme Court case right now. It's a federal Supreme Court case. If anybody wants to look this case up, I will give them the number. Okay. For your show, on your show, George.
Okay.
But, what happened? Okay. If you're ready to copy, I'll tell you right now.
Okay. Go ahead. Say it.
Okay. My case number for this federal Supreme Court concerning what happened to me and my rendition and torture, okay, is this case number 14-15050. Okay, 14-15050. Okay, that is the Supreme Court case concerning what happened to me in Iraq. All right. And that is basically me versus the command of the intelligence unit that I was assigned to. Okay. So, you can look that up, and you can look up all those people, look them up on Google. Okay. For, you know, to get a better picture of what I was dealing with.
Right.
So anyway, I know we must be getting short on time because, okay, Mr. There I was, all right, facing the scandal, the horrendous scandal of war crimes that the U.S. had committed at Abu Ghraib prison. To say I was between a rock and a hard spot would be about right. Okay. And I was the medic who had to treat all those people that we had damaged during our kinder and gentler interrogations. All right. So, you know, so to make a long story short, yes, there I was. And of course, the command, when I filed charges, whistleblower charges, when I filed those charges in Iraq at Abu Ghraib, the response was, there is no problem. This is from the command, Thomas Pappas, by the way, Colonel Thomas Pappas. Okay. He stated very simply, there is no problem here at Abu Ghraib prison in Iraq. And the only problem that we can see is you, and you are going to be strapped to a stretcher and flown out of Iraq, against your will. Okay. They call it rendition or abduction, and you're going to be flying out of Iraq. Unbeknownst to anybody, okay, there was no official orders releasing me from the military or releasing me from that site, okay. There, basically, I'm coming to you and telling you and your listeners, George, that basically I'm still in Iraq because no orders have ever been issued or cut, you know, excusing me from Iraq, so. You could say I'm AWOL from Iraq at this point. So anyway, with all this trauma and trouble that was going on with me dealing with this, rogue command who, by the way, that's referred to, my unit is called the Rogue Command by my general. the General Janice Karpinski, she refers to this my command as the as a rogue, out of control command. So anyway, to make a long story short, hopefully, I was strapped to a stretcher, phone out, but then at that point, Mr. Baghdadi, Al Baghdadi, okay, was taken and put into a camp called Camp Buka, okay, and Camp Buka was like a torture central. They call it an interrogation center, but it was basically a torture center. And Mr. Baghdadi, who was very smart, very tough, very sharp, okay, knew his business, and he realized he could study the Americans at this Camp Buka, okay, B-U-C-C-A, okay, Camp Buka. And he studied the Americans, and that's where he started his recruiting process for ISIS, okay? ISIS, okay, I call it the intelligence secret, Israel Secret Intelligence Service, or ISIS for short, okay? That's what I call it, all right? And he realized that he had access to everybody's personnel records via this database system, and he knew all about the Americans, and he was getting supply from the Americans and the Israelis at this point. So when he was finally released, walked out of the gate at Camp Buka, he knew exactly who the people were, or who the Sunni recruits were that had been tortured and abused by the Americans. He knew where he could find them, and he knew he had the financing to start up a surrogate proxy insurgent army, or in this case, an insurgent army of terrorists. All right. So he walks out the gate, and he goes and collects all his extremely tough, angry, well-trained, very sharp soldiers, ISIS soldiers, terrorists. Okay, and proceeds to set them up in a military style fashion. All right. And which he did, and very effective. And I'm sure anybody going back and looking at some records, you know, pictorial records of this group will see that the funny thing is that most of them are driving around in U.S. supplied, vehicles and being, you know, whenever they move anywhere, they were being actually covered, you know, by Apache helicopters, and also ISIS was given several thousand new trucks, you know, to transport themselves in. So yes, so that's what Mr. Baghdadi walked into, and of course there's all kinds of other intrigues that go on with this story. So that's what I know, and by this time, I had been shipped out, and my story is rather a dramatic and adventurous. Okay, I'd been shipped out, but I was indeed tortured en route. Okay, and interrogated chemically by what are called MK Ultra drugs, and those are the drugs that the American CIA uses on intelligence agents that have extensive training, like myself, and I was. I was actually shipped out to Germany, okay, after a very rigorous flight, as you might imagine, and then from Germany, I was then because when I was in Germany, actually at that point, I contacted my lawyer, okay, a lawyer, California lawyer, a JAG lawyer, and he was actually en route to Germany to find me, pick me up, and file charges against the United States government for what had happened to me. And from there, I did leave, and this was the irony was doesn't stop there. I left Ramstein, Germany, and I was shipped to Fort Sam Houston, okay, Fort Sam Houston in Texas, and there, okay, I had several people meet me, okay, surprisingly enough, meet me, And that started a whole investigation about how I'd come out, left Iraq, gotten out of Iraq, and what was going on, and what the United States was doing, what kind of war crimes that had been implicated by the United States government, okay, at Abu Ghraib. That's where it started actually happening right there. So at this point, I need to say, have you gotten any questions or have any questions, George?
Yeah. You have this lawsuit, right? This filing up in the Supreme Court level. How has been your physical state? Has it taken a while to recover, or are you still having physical problems?
Yes, I think you can tell. I am having problems. This time last year, I was actually in a coma. Okay, I lapsed into a coma,
okay,
which was a direct result of the MK Ultra drugs that they administered during my interrogation.
Right. Okay.
Basically, all right. And so I lapsed into a coma, and I had to spend probably half of last year. Okay, this last year, learning how to speak again. Okay, this is, everything you're hearing is, of course, it's being done with great difficulty, okay, for your show.
Right.
Being done with great difficulty, but it's what resulted from me learning how to speak again after being in a coma for several months.
Right.
At that point last year. So, and of course I do, and this is in the book, I do, and yes, it did damage my heart substantially. And like I said, I had a cerebral vascular hemorrhage is what they call it, or a cerebral vascular accident, to put it in proper medical language. So that's what I had last year. And so, if you remember, George, I didn't do too many shows for you last year because
right.
I wasn't able to. I was in a coma.
Right.
Okay.
Well, I want to thank you this evening, Frank. And, boy, you've been through hell. I know that. And we certainly appreciate everything you've done. And this was Frank Gregory Ford, and his book is Midnight in Samarra. You can find it on Amazon, and I highly recommend it. But thank you so much for being with us this evening, Frank Gregory Ford.
Thank you, George. It was a pleasure being here, as always.
And we'll talk again. And, boy, I tell you what, when you put it out, you put it out straight. You're a straight shooter, and I respect that. Okay.
By the way, next time you speak, I probably will have received the Congressional Medal of Honor, the
really?
CMH.
Really?
Okay. Yes. I've been nominated by General Dennis Karpinski,
okay,
and I have a secondary support by a Major General John Harrell.
Okay.
Okay. And they have. They have made the recommendation that I be given the Congressional Medal of Honor.
Boy, that would be good. Well, think of me first, okay? To announce that, okay?
Okay, thank you so much,
okay,
George. I greatly appreciate it.
Thank you, Frank Gregory Ford. You're a stand-up person. Thank you very much. Good night.
My pleasure.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.